I don't think we really have that many Jews that listen to us anyway, so.
Okay. You're telling me there's not that many Jews in the South who listen
Believe it or not, yeah.
to... They'll catch on eventually.
Yeah.
I'll just give it to the rabbi down the street to listen to.
You're just like living in the Jewish section of town or what?
We lovingly call it Jewville. I am literally right across the street from the Jewish Community Center. The rabbi lives down the street from me. There's a whole lot of Jewish people that live around me. My roommate is Jewish. Like
Nice.
I was like, I live in the cutest little village.
The shtetl.
Yeah.
Yep.
She doesn't have a plot for potatoes in her backyard yet.
Hey, I was actually planning on growing those.
Part of the South, not your daddy's Appalachia. Part of the South, progress cannot wait.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pod of the South, a production of Change Tennessee. Pull up a chair and refill your sweet tea as we peel back the layers of Southern politics to get a better understanding of what's going on and why it matters. My name is Gabe, and joining me today, as always, is Knoxville's gayest forger of shiny math rocks, Maggie Loveday.
I saw new math rocks the other day and I got really excited.
How shiny were they?
They were so shiny.
And today we're joined by an old friend of mine and sociology professor and sociologist, Jonathan Rich.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you again for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Definitely interested to see kind of your side of diving into the mind of people, especially when we jump in today's topic, which is why billionaires suck and are a drain on society, or better known as wealth inequality. But before we jump into that, what's something that you feel needs a good spotlight right now?
What is a good spotlight? You know, that's a great question. Putting me on the spot. I think putting a spotlight on Jeff Bezos is a good one because he really screwed up with this Amazon union drive, and now he's flying into outer space, you know, and destroying the planet and spending untold millions of his own money that could have been redirected into helping people. So I think I would put my spotlight on him right now.
Whether it's taking his brother in, who's like a crappy clone of him, or selling off the other seat for it was like $28 million that he auctioned off a seat for. That's a lot of money that could have, like you just said, could have go to so much better things than going into some, you know, corporate foundation that's just going to really end up lining the pockets of the PMCs and people who probably don't really need more money.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree.
And then not to mention, you know, he had the audacity afterwards to say, you know, he was able to achieve it because of all of Amazon's customers. Like,
well, the one thing that I would say, just to briefly throw in a little theory, is that he actually was kind of proving that the labor theory of value is true, which is the idea that the wealth that corporations or, you know, the capitalist class has is really created by the labor that their workers perform. And so he basically said, you know, all of my workers and all of the customers who made this happen. So in a way, he was implicitly admitting that the labor theory of value is correct.
Your background is in Marxism and Marxist theory, so you can kind of shit, like, I'm probably going to mess up this, but he took like the scientific approach and did it to like the theory of labor and value, where it's like everything has to be in equilibrium, everything has to be in balance. On one side of the equation, you have raw products and laborers, and then your catalyst is their work. And on the other side, you have finished product and profit. So everything has to be in sync. So like, if there's more surplus value, that means the value of the laborers should go up as well. In science, you know, you can't have an equation out of equilibrium, out of balance. Everything has to be equal in, equal out.
Right.
But assholes like Bezos are just like, oh no, I'm creating more money that I get to take because I created it.
Exactly. And yeah, and we could talk about that too. Is it, you talked about science and the equation, and Marx had a very famous equation that he created in his book, Das Kapital, Volume 1, where he talks about it's the general circulation of money And basically he argued that the way capitalists circulate commodities is they start out with money that they use to purchase commodities, then workers perform some kind of production on those commodities so that capitalists can then trade the commodities for a higher value of money than what they started with, which is what profit comes from. And so the idea of this equation was to show that all of profit is created by workers, but is sort of appropriated by capitalists. And I think Bezos is a good example of that.
He's literally done, has contributed very little outside of putting hundreds of businesses out, but has reaped all of the benefits that his laborers have done.
Exactly. And of course, as you mentioned, monopolistic practices, predatory practices that Amazon uses to kind of coerce smaller businesses into falling in line behind them.
Yeah, we talk about how much we hate Walmart for doing that, but Amazon is exactly the same. They're just in the digital realm. I mean, a bully is a bully. And when your business is predicated on forcing others to sell their product below what the market should be for their product, makes you a bad guy, makes you a terrible company.
And I recently had a class I taught my students where we had, we watched a documentary about the history of Amazon. And really for the first several years that Amazon was in business, they actually didn't turn a profit. They were kind of running in the red with their budget. And Bezos was able to kind of convince the shareholders that, you know, the profits will come in the long term, but you know, he kind of saw himself as a technological visionary of sorts. And so at the time when, you know, this was in the 90s, the idea that you would have an online store that would replace brick and mortar stores was still kind of unheard of. And of course, Amazon started out just selling books, but Bezos's plan from the beginning was that it would be kind of a one-stop shop where you can literally buy any consumer product. And that was always, I will admit, a very innovative idea, but at the same time was requiring extreme exploitation of workers and a lot of predatory monopolistic practices towards other businesses. So it's something that really deserves a lot of criticism as well.
You can be innovative without being a monster.
Right.
I mean, there's a great example, like you see all these like 16-year-olds and shit, like developing all these ways to like cut back on pollution and stuff that people have never thought of. And they're just like, oh yeah, I made this thing and I just gave it away because, you know, we need to save the oceans.
Yeah, like we need to save the planet. What do you mean I could make a profit off of this?
Well, and one thing that's interesting, there was a book that came out recently called The People's Republic of Walmart, which was about, well, it was about Walmart, but it also applies perfectly well to Amazon. And the idea in this book is that companies like Walmart and Amazon are actually, they function as central planned economies in and of themselves. And so in a way, the argument in this book is that a socialist planned economy using the sort of digital internet tools that we have could actually work very well because Amazon kind of proves that you can do that.
Yeah, and they don't even do it just through that. They do also use the data mining for Whole Foods as well.
Thanks to guys like Bezos and his ilk, the robot overlords are coming, but we're going way down the rabbit hole. We've got a lot to discuss. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to jump right into wealth inequality and how we got there. Stay tuned. This week's episode is brought to you by Charles Koch. As one of America's oldest members of the ever-increasing billionaire class, he has made it his life goal to increase the wealth gap between him and the rest of the people at Koch Industries. Going all the way back to the 1980s, he has dedicated himself to increasing his own wealth at the expense of the general public and his workers. Charles Koch, I can always use more money. Everybody, again, thank you for tuning in. And to start off this conversation about wealth inequality, it really kind of comes down to two big distinctions of people in the United States. All that real boils down to is like your class identity. I mean, we talk about, you know, identity politics and all that, where they try to pit different, you know, races or whatever against each other. But all that really boils down to are class identities. You have the Bezoses, the Musks we were talking about. So you have your ruling class, and then you have pretty much everybody else in any given time period, any given society, you have the working class. And that's really what human civilization boils down to, is an elite versus an everyone else. So Jonathan, I'm really, like, again, like, this being kind of your background, really curious kind of your thoughts on how we got here to where, you know, they don't really talk about it anymore, how it's, everything's kind of mucked up, but really it all still boils down to these two, ruling class versus working class issues.
Yeah, that's a great summary. The way I would kind of address that is, you know, I think that how you describe it is the way that Marxist sociologists interpret the class structure, which is that the primary contradiction in class society is between the capitalist class and the working class. But I would say that the sort of the mainstream view in sociology, what I would call the bourgeois sociology view, is that there is not a class struggle between capitalists and workers. Instead, the way that mainstream bourgeois sociologists would define class is based on what is now called socioeconomic status. And that is what you kind of create a statistical composition of a person's education level, their income level, and their kind of background like that, kind of a cultural dimension. And so their education, their what type of job they have, and their income. And so that, instead of having a kind of two classes who are opposed to each other, what that does is it creates this like gradation where there's a scale going from lower class to lower middle to upper middle to upper. And it's like this endless gradation of classes. And none of those classes are inherently in contradiction with one another, in antagonist relationship to one another. So the way that I look at it as a Marxist theorist doing that type of sociology is that I would say that the definition of class identity for me would be based on the who owns the means of production. And that's something that just looking at your income or your educational level doesn't tell you. And so really, I would say the central question is the issue of private ownership over the means of production. And by that, I mean, there is a certain group of people who have control over the land, over the factories, over the businesses, over the banks. And then there are another group of people who don't control land or banks or businesses, and they are forced to sell themselves in exchange for a wage or a salary to the people who do own those means of production. So I would say that from a Marxist sociological perspective, the two basic class identities that are in a conflict or an antagonistic relationship would be based on who owns and who does not own the means of production.
That's interesting, because especially you talking, like, kind of drawing the comparisons to like landowners and business owners. You know, we were kind of making jokes about Chapo right before we started recording, but Matt Christman does the exact same thing in their new show, Hall of Presidents, where back in the colony state, we were essentially like a feudal system with landowners, but we ran out of land. There weren't any more people to kick off land and claim it for capitalists. And so it transformed into business owners. And now, you know, your small business owners are essentially those same like feudal landowners you said it doesn't matter what the actual income is of that person. You have a single individual that gets to control a multitude of individuals below them, and thusly like creating that hierarchy, that structured hierarchy you were talking about, where it's like, well, if I'm in this one, because that's the bourgeois approach, you know, I'm in this one, so they have to be down here. They can't be equal to me.
Yeah, and small business owners also, you know, typically in Marxist theory, the idea is that the working class and the capitalist class are the two, what Marx called revolutionary classes. And by that, he means that he thought that the working class is the kind of group that has the power to transform society. But he didn't think that those were the only two classes. So, for example, he talked a lot about the petty bourgeois which is what he defined as, you know, small business owners. And he kind of described them as a class that was kind of in a contradiction between the workers and the capitalists. Because if we're going to go like to look at Amazon, Amazon is destroying a lot of small businesses, you know, these kind of mom and pop shops. And so this famous passage in Communist Manifesto, he talks about the petty bourgeois is going to be pushed down into the ranks of the working class, because once their businesses start getting swallowed up by the big capitalists, then they're going to fall down into the level of being a wage laborer again. And so I think that's another important part of the question, is kind of getting the people who are small business owners to see if they will stand in alliance with the working class against the big capitalists. And I think that's an important part of it.
Definitely something to look at, because we are so divided, but not along the gradations where we need to be, where we should be divided. Like you're saying, like where it should be capitalists versus working class, I believe. Instead, you know, we're dividing on 18 other different fronts, when the middle petty bourgeois and the working class, they're the, like I said, the revolutionary, like they should be the ones that are calling the shots. But instead, we're letting us get divided amongst each other and making it easier for the big capitalists to come in and compound the issues and push that exist and push down the petty bourgeois into the working class, making that a bigger group, but a group that is filled with infighting. Because now it's you workers wanting more money, like you workers wanting a living wage is why this didn't work, rather than it's like, no, these assholes just exploited the hell out of all of us.
Yeah, and it's, and competition between people who are workers is a part of the system. It's a feature of the system, I think, because capitalism, you have, well, first of all, capitalists themselves, the businesses, are competing against each other because they are trying to compete for profit margin. And so even if you're a capitalist, you're sort of, yeah, you're in alliance with the other capitalists, but you're also competing against them. And then for the workers, you know, if you work for a living, there's only a finite number of jobs you can apply for. And so every worker is kind of put into a situation where you're in competition for scarce jobs, for scarce resources, for scarce housing and whatnot, where you see yourself in a competitive relationship with all the other people. And so it leads to alienation, where you feel, instead of having commonality and solidarity with your fellow working class people, you feel like they're a threat to you, and you have to fight against them, and you have to compete against them to get just a little piece of the pie for yourself. And so that's a real big problem, is, you know, polarization and division, when the only way to really change the situation would be if we could bring people together and unite them.
We've been having those conversations at my current work. I work at a brewery currently, and there's one guy who wants to be the like assistant manager, and he gets really huffy with other people, like the other full-time employees. That includes me, because he thinks we're all coming for his job, and we're like, nah, man, we don't want that job. We just want to pour beer. Thanks. Right. Like, I'm not in competition with you. I just want to pour beer.
Yeah, an assistant manager is kind of a thankless job anyway, right?
It is. Like, you're not doing anything fun. I don't want that job.
Just have more responsibility and maybe like slightly better pay, but not much.
Not even. Yeah.
You know, we've kind of been talking from a, you know, from a capitalist versus workers, but these kind of keep these like class divisions up within, from a government standpoint as well. I mean, Maggie, you pointed out right before we started recording, or you might have texted me earlier today about it, how they can use the education system to keep these divisions in place through like military recruiting, by preying on lower income areas as like a, hey, this is how you can escape the doldrums of this low income area. You can enlist.
Yeah. And that's what it was for the town that I grew up in. It was not about like going to college or anything like that. It was like, you're going to join the military and leave. You're not going to get good enough grades or be good enough to go to a higher college to get a good degree and leave. Which sucks, because you're not even building the town up better by doing that. You could be building the town up by having people going out and getting educated and then come back and bringing what they learned back with them. to make the town better.
That second point of what you kind of just said is huge, because like the vast majority of the people who I know who went into the military came back out of the military and became blue collar working class individuals.
Yep.
You know, they're carpenters, they're flooring installers, they're welders, you know, they're promised the moon and given a, you know, a thing of Swiss cheese and be like, see, it's got holes in it too. The structures we have put in place cross-cutting, whether you're talking like private sector or public sector.
And of course, even the military pipeline is still a broken system, because those, you know, people come back from doing whatever they were doing in the military, and if they're overseas in any way, form, or fashion, they come back broken people.
Yeah, I teach a community college, and so a lot of my students are veterans who are coming back. And so I see it. And even when I grew up, when I was in high school, was during the Bush administration, during the 9/11 and the Iraq War. And that was really my first introduction to politics. And so I was inspired by the anti-war protests and all of that. And as I started getting more into sociology and reading theory about it, I was always interested in why are there these wars? And, you know, so one of the things that I like always has inspired me about that was Vladimir Lenin's book called Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. It, within one country, once the corporations reach these level of becoming monopolies, they really can't make enough money in their own land. So they are sort of forced to export themselves to foreign soil. And that leads to this competition among the imperialist nations to divide up the world amongst themselves. Using the military, and then of course all the resources and the wealth and can be extracted and sent back to the home country. So I think that's something that plays into what you're talking about. And then of course, for the perspective of the soldiers, they're basically serving as the cannon fodder for these wars that are fought for profit, essentially.
Guatemala is very familiar with this United Fruit Company. Only the most upstanding individuals ran that company in the 80s. You know,
CIA wasn't involved in that in any way, form, or fashion at all.
Or Panama. You know, the Panamanians aren't capable of controlling their own land. We need to control this canal. Yeah, the list goes on. Colombia, Iran with their oil back in the 50s. And again, it's all going back to prop up these capitalists, these oligarchs that, I forget who it was, but it was right after World War II. It was a U.S. official said, you know, we control nearly 50% of the global economy. Why shouldn't we control more of it? It's a terrifying thought when your elected officials are like, you know, it'd be great if we controlled all of the world wealth instead of just our proportionate amount. You know, all the money keeps getting taken from the working class, from indigenous populations all over the world, in our own country here in the US, and it keeps concentrating up at a handful of individuals. And it's only gotten so much more concentrated.
Yeah, one of the things that I talked about with some fellow artists here in town, like one of the biggest issues is that, so say you want to get some art supplies, so you go to Joann's or Michael's. We even have a little tiny small like art shop called Jerry's Artorama that you can go to and get art supplies. But however, they don't carry everything because not everything is, you know, popular, or it doesn't sell very well. So they don't carry everything possible. So then what do smaller cities have to or towns have to resort to for artists to get materials? They have to go online, and the easiest thing to do is go to Amazon. And I was like, I hate it, like, that I need to get these materials, and the easiest place for me to get it is here.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And that's why I think hopefully appropriating Amazon or nationalizing it or having it run by the workers instead of the people like Jeff Bezos, that could be a silver lining to it, because it does have so much wealth and power and so much information. So it seems like it could be something that we could use against them and take for ourselves.
Especially kind of what you were talking about, Maggie, with like the art stores, you know. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's money that's being taken out of the petty bourgeois, which are a lot, you know, should be aligned with the working class, and just going into these oligarchs and going into these hyper-capitalists that are just going to be hoarding the wealth.
Yeah, and I think also with the bringing up the small businesses, as you and I, or as we all know in this room, I mean, a lot of times the small business petty bourgeois types tend to be a bit reactionary. They're at least aware that, you know, they're being screwed over. but they don't really have a sort of class consciousness a lot of the time. And so, you know, they could be susceptible to embracing reactionary, you know, right-wing politics. And so I think that's a very important reason why people need to emphasize the class struggle, the working class, because if you don't emphasize that, then it's going to create all kinds of scapegoating and propaganda and divisions that are going to target minority groups or just different groups of people who are not to blame for why, you know, mom and pop store went out of business.
Blaming the other working class for the thing that's like, oh, well, you didn't shop here often enough. And I'm like, well, you didn't have anything that I needed. Like, what am I supposed to do?
Or, yeah, you're talking about scapegoating. Yeah, that's a big one, especially here in the South and especially North Georgia, where we were, you know, where it had a huge concentration of Hispanic individuals. Good God, I don't know how many, like, you could not go down, like, walk around Athens or like parts of Athens, like once you left our little UGA bubble, and not hear somebody like going off on some racist tirade against migrant workers.
It was very interesting when we were visiting Baton Rouge and New Orleans. It was similar, but it, instead, like the separation was like Hispanics and then Creole. And it was like the weirdest thing to hear, because it would be a Black person talking, making racist remarks about a Creole person who's also Black. Like, I was like, what is happening here? And it's all because they're like, you know, they're blaming each other. They can't, instead of banding together, they would rather point fingers. And that's what ends up happening.
Rather than looking at like the multinational construction conglomerates that are coming in and are saying, oh no, we're only going to pay $11 an hour for this job. It's like, well, that's where the problem is, not your fellow workers.
Yeah. And it's interesting to also deal with it from a gender perspective, because rather than women building up other women, there's constantly this hierarchy that's happening where they're trying to make women against other women rather than women building up women.
I think it works that way. I mean, whether it's race or nationality or gender or religion or, you know, whatever characteristic you want to pick out, it's always ripe for, you know, using that to divide people. And just as an example, I was watching a video clip on YouTube of Tucker Carlson on Fox News, and he was kind of railing against the big businesses and saying about tech monopolies and this and that. And then immediately after, he kind of started talking about immigrants are taking your job. So he was sort of halfway in the right direction, but then immediately like kind of shifting the blame onto a population of people who are poor workers who don't even have citizenship, instead of putting the blame where it really is, which is the people at the top. Yeah. So it's a bad situation. It's very difficult to overcome. And I feel that America's in the last couple of years has become even more divided and polarized than it has been before. And it seems to be getting worse and worse.
And that kind of leads into the next thing. Even Tucker Carlson like started going down the right path and then hard cut to like, oh good God. You know, these class striations and divisiveness are propped up by our political system. Like as a two-party system, your options are, no matter who, you know, which side of the aisle you're on, if you want to again go left-right dichotomy, it's either the good guys or the bad guys. There's no compromise alternative or third party alternative that says, hey, both of y'all suck because XYZ. Like, our political system enables this division to happen and thrives off of it, because they can fundraise and they can campaign off of what the other side is doing, and there's no one to call them out without being the enemy.
Yeah, and I always noticed this, because I grew up in the South and I'm from Georgia, but I now live in California, and just going from a red state to a blue state, and I kind of see how political consciousness in terms of electoral politics, how it functions, is that it's really, in my view, I think the Democratic and Republican parties are sort of both capitalist and imperialist parties. And I think that I kind of tend to see them as two sides of the same coin in terms of their actual policies. But I think that what they do is that they signify to different segments of the country. They have a sort of different cultural identity that they appeal to. And obviously, the Republicans appeal to the South, the Midwest, and small towns, you know, straight white Christian and male America, what have you, traditionalists. And the Democrats appeal to the more progressive and diversity and all of that. And I think so a lot of the problem with that is that if you think that politics is polarized around liberals versus conservatives, then it keeps you kind of divided from your fellow man and woman, from other people. You see other people who live in Georgia as your enemy, rather than seeing the ruling class, the capitalist class, as the enemy. So it kind of makes us, it prevents us from really uniting with people. So one thing I've been really trying to brainstorm a lot is just how can we transcend these sort of culture wars? Because I think underneath that culture war, it's really a class struggle that's being masked by a culture division. Yeah. And so I think we really need to get through that and find a way to cut through down to the class issue.
Absolutely. I work in, I've talked about it before on the show, I work in manufacturing as my day job. And manufacturing in the South especially is very, you know, Republican, right wing, however you want to frame it. But I can go and I can talk to almost anybody on the manufacturing floor with me. And the moment I talk about like class struggle, they are all on board 100%. You know, the moment you start getting into like identity politics and, you know, talking about minorities and things like that, about trying to get equal rights for women or something like that, you know, they shut off. But when you talk about like, well, at the root of all of this is having a group of people for them, for our bosses to say, well, if you don't want to work for this wage, I can bring group X in and pay them $1.50 less an hour and they'll take the job.
One of my like weirdest experiences as far as politics and workplace was when I worked at Earth Fair, which is kind of like a Whole Foods kind of thing. A lot of the people that I worked with were Republican, and it was really weird because this is a hippie store. And so like, here's like everyone that comes into shop is like all these hippie dippies and stuff like that. And then all the workers are Republican kind of esque politics. And so having conversations with them is where I got a lot of my knowledge for like what the other side sees kind of thing. And as soon as I brought up like any type of classism, it was the same thing, Gabe. It was like, ah, blah, blah, blah. We hate the uppers, higher ups, blah, blah, blah. And actually, the whole company ended up going down because the CEO was embezzling money from the company. Wow. It's so wild to be in the South and have those conversations and be like, hey, you know, this is something that unites all of us. And they're like, well, I don't know. And I'd be like, wait a second, get it together.
Yeah, I agree. That's similar to conversations I've had with so many people. The one thing I also kind of want to bring up is that one of the most common responses that I hear from the left when I talk about Marxist or class struggle is that I'm a class reductionist, meaning that by emphasizing the working class, it means that somehow you cannot care about racism or sexism or anti-Semitism or homophobia or something. And I think that's kind of a misconception, because at least as I see it, I think the big distinction is that people who are not from a Marxist or sort of historical materialist perspective, they kind of look at something like race in a very reductionistic way, where they assume that the reason why there is racism is simply because white people have bad ideas that are in their minds, that white people have prejudices and ignorance, and they need to be sort of educated. And that's why we have seen a rise in the last year, especially of a corporate diversity training industry with people like Robin DiAngelo, who get paid a lot of money to go to companies and tell the workers, you know, you need to stop being so privileged and white and unlearn your whiteness. And I think that there's nothing, it's not that I don't think that white people have prejudices and privileges and bigotries and racism, but I think the root cause of that is in the class structure. I think, for example, if you look at immigration, you can spend all day lecturing some guy at a manufacturing job how he should be not racist towards immigrants. But I think the deeper issue is that capitalism has pitted workers against each other. on the basis of nationality. And so if you're a worker and you see your job might be shipped overseas, or someone who might come in and start working for a lower wage and then you lose your job, then it's a situation that it's easy for you to fall into the trap of blaming that person or blaming that ethnic group for it. On those issues, I think it's a matter of scarcity and competition for those finite resources that are kind of, a lot of that explains why certain groups of people are so susceptible to being bought off into these kind of identity-based antagonisms and racisms and all of that.
But like a lot of, yeah, like you're saying, Jonathan, a lot of these structures go back to pitting groups against each other for the sake of creating class, to create divisiveness, to, again, we've said it 100 times at this point, to prop up the capitalists, to that way they can harvest more profit from them.
And the first capitalists in America were the British.
The first, the first Industrial Revolution is also in England. So
yeah, and then a lot of the reasons why we have such issues with pitting against each other is because of misinformation and ignorance rather than education.
You know, I think freshman year high school, boom, every student should be required to read some Howard Zinn.
People's history.
Because he tells the stories that aren't in your history books. Yeah. I'd come home and I'd be like, you want to hear what the U.S. government did to this group of working class individuals? You want to hear what they did to this union when they decided to strike? They called in the National Guard and shot 8 people to death.
Yeah.
It's like, literally, it was like every day for a week of like, hey, here's another massacre we did against the working class. You know, we're talking about how like the government doing all this stuff. I mean, and even obviously we have labor laws today, thank God. So we don't have to send the toddlers into the coal mines anymore. But, you know, they've kind of tweaked it now where now they can prop it up through tax breaks, where a capitalist can come in and say, hey, I'm going to bring my business to this area, but in order to do that, I need $50 million in tax breaks or in tax credits. The thing that comes to mind the most are sports stadiums. I mean, we're talking about billionaires are asking money to build a vanity project.
Yep, that's what's happening downtown Knoxville.
And they're called owners too, which is, you know, it almost sounds reminiscent to like slave plantations or something.
Yeah, I always felt it really awkward when somebody was like, yeah, I own the Tennessee Titans. And I was like, what?
Define own. Oh, yeah. Okay. You paid a lot of money for a group of grown men to entertain you.
When you put it that way, it really sounds totally messed up, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, there we're talking millionaires versus billionaires, but you're still talking about that hyper-concentrated group of individuals at the top exploiting the labor of others to create more wealth for themselves. So again, even when you're talking about in the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, there's still exploitation coming through. As long as there's one person higher up on the totem pole than you, they're going to be doing their damnedest to make sure that they get theirs and you get as little of yours as you can.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that the example of sports teams is a good one, because as I was mentioning earlier about how mainstream sociology just looks at, you know, socioeconomic status as income level and all of that. And so by that definition, they would probably say that someone who is an athlete who plays on a sports team, they're wealthy, they have fame. And so they would say, oh, they're not workers and whatnot. But, you know, if you look at it in the sense that, as you're describing, they are also laborers in a way. They perform and they don't own the team that they perform for. And the people that do own the team essentially are raking in billions. And there's also the question of like the injuries that football players receive in terms of traumatic brain injury that leads to early onset of Alzheimer's and all kinds of other illnesses. So it's kind of a total, like, you know, barbaric practice in a lot of ways, even though they are being compensated much better than, you know, the average worker. But it's still a situation where the way that the sports team's ownership is structured is one that's based on exploitation, and not just of the workers, but exploitation of the cities. They leech off of the public funds from the taxpayers. Amazon did this. I mean, when they went to say, where are we going to build our new headquarters? They literally produced a bidding war they pitted every city in America against each other and said, which mayor is going to offer us the most tax breaks to open a factory here? It's really a backwards situation.
And you could even use the Olympics currently in Tokyo as a example as well, because of the, I mean, like they went through and kicked a whole bunch of people out of their houses. And I mean, it was really like, it's really sad if you look at the history of what follows the Olympics and what comes before the Olympics.
All for, you know, the people at Procter and Gamble and Kimberly-Clark to sell a few extra boxes of Kleenex or body wash. Yep. This one has the Nike swoosh and Simone Biles on it.
It would be nice if we could enjoy like human athletic skills without having to buy into all of this other marketing and greed and abuse of players and all that stuff.
These people are awesome people, but the amount of capitalism that goes into them sucks.
Amateur sports doesn't exist anymore, because even at the college level, you know, we've been talking about international, professional, the college level where it is supposed to be amateur play. And yeah, the school's making, I think UGA, like every game day, UGA football would generate like $12 million per game day. You know, you're one play away from tearing your ACL and ruining your career, and they got nothing for it. The university owned their name, image, likeness. You know, the players couldn't profit off of it at all.
Yeah, they just recently did a court case where they were able to give students money.
Name, image, likeness. Yeah, the Supreme Court finally ruled that players own their own name, image, likeness to allow these players a modicum of profitability from their selves.
I think this is a good example of what you were talking about earlier, about how if you were to just not use any political labels and just talk to people about these issues, about how everyone's getting screwed over by these big businesses, I think that like most Americans love sports. And I think this conversation we're having right now could be a good way of just opening up that for people and like realizing like, hey, your favorite pastime, watching college football, those people that you love to watch who do those amazing things on TV every day, that's people that are getting screwed over. They literally aren't getting even paid for all this money they're generating for their university. So it's a good introduction into class struggle, maybe.
Anyway, so we've gone a lot into kind of just the systems that have created all of this wealth inequality. We've kind of touched a little bit of what we can do, but again, kind of being on the front lines of the educating people on these issues, Jonathan, kind of what are some of the things that, you know, that the average citizen could do, that, you know, that we could do going into work tomorrow, stuff that kind of you've seen be successful or stuff that you've taught that, you know, has really clicked the light bulb for some of your students?
That's a really good question. It's very difficult because I don't know how to answer like what the biggest question is, what is to be done? And the problem with that is that I don't think that there's anything that you can really do to change this system from an individual level. Like you can try to resist on an individual basis, but I think ultimately it's really going to require a sort of collective action on the part of people, like multiple people and a mass of people coming together to change this, because the reason why the workers, I think, are so important and so revolutionary or potentially revolutionary is because workers are who create the wealth. Like, for example, the football players are the ones who generate all the revenue because they're the ones who are performing, not the team owner. And you can look at any industry, whether it's manufacturing or whether it's the service industry or what have you. The workers do have that power because they're the ones who do the labor that creates the products that are sold for profit for the capitalists. So unless we get to a point where we start overcoming these divisions and start, you know, having more united solidarity with each other to build a sort of collective mass movement, I think that's the only way ultimately to change the system. Other than that, I think you can educate yourself. You can try to resist oppression and exploitation on a personal level as an individual, but that will only get you so far without the whole mass movement behind it. And there is the biggest challenge. And I don't have really an answer of how to make that mass movement appear, but that's really, I think, what is necessary.
To get that solidarity, we just kind of have to keep preaching to the people who are most affected by the divisions, you know, our fellow workers, whether it's you know, the professional athlete who's being exploited for their physical prowess, or the person who's, you know, making burritos at Chipotle, you know, solidarity across the board, and understanding that there is a common quote unquote enemy. There is somebody who sees what your worth is on paper and then knows what they can demean you to make you think your worth is.
Yeah. And I think we're living in a time that's, there is potential for change, because when you invited me on this podcast, I was doing a little research about inequality, and one thing is inequality has been growing for several decades, but especially in the last 10 years since the collapse of the financial institutions and Wall Street and the Great Recession. That was a catastrophic crisis that was, you know, the worst since the Great Depression. And since then, we have not recovered. Income distribution has only been more polarized to the top since then. And then, of course, the coronavirus pandemic has completely decimated the working class, not just in terms of like mass unemployment, but like literally people dying by the thousands. And there's no relief coming in terms of, you know, healthcare and this and that. And what Congress does, they pass the CARES Act, which it did provide some unemployment insurance, but it mostly gave trillions of dollars to the billionaires and the millionaires and the big businesses. So I think we're living in a time where there is more than ever, like the potential for people to see that the system is not working. You know, if everything was going great, the economy was working good for everybody, then it would be a lot harder to convince people of this stuff. But I think most people kind of feel in their gut and in their bones, they know, hey, the system is kind of fucked up right now and things aren't going well. But I think, at least for me as an educator, I want to try to always help people identify what I think is the true culprit and the true cause, instead of having people say, oh, it's these immigrants, or it's this group, or it's that group. Like, you know, actually identify, hey, this is the real problem, and the problem is capitalism. And so that's really the main focus I try to do as a teacher.
talking about the pandemic, like that was one of the most infuriating elements is what, you know, we live in a global news environment now where we got to watch like literally every other developed nation's government step in and be like, oh, hey, everyone's out of work right now. Everybody gets, you know, $1,000 a month, or, you know, I forgot, like, I think it was like New Zealand. Yeah, it was like $1,500 a month or something like that. What did we get in America? $1,200 check, and then $1,400, and then a $600 check. Like,
yeah,
it's like,
and no healthcare assistance for those that did have COVID.
We just watched our own government like shit the bed, while we got to see every other developed nation's government step in and take care of their citizens. And most of those governments that stepped in are socialist or democratic socialist nations, or at least more so in the U.S.
And a big thing, you know, is the rise of, at least for workers who are in like fields like mine, like education or something like that, is transitioning everything to Zoom and to online services. And that, of course, I think just enhances the power of these big tech monopolies in Silicon Valley, who have even more kind of control over everything that we do and say and hear and read. And on top of that, just being stuck indoors all the time, afraid if you walk out and talk to your neighbor, you're going to get sick and die. That, I think, also puts a damper on ability to organize collectively as a movement. And so it makes it so that everyone's more individualistic, everyone's atomized, people don't trust each other. So all of these things are actually beneficial to the people at the top. I mean, they really allow them to get wealthier than they've ever been in human history, pretty much. I think the latest data is like, I think 7 billionaires own more wealth than the entire planet combined, something like that. So the only good silver lining, I think, is that all these trends are opening people's eyes, and everyone is a bit more skeptical of institutions. Everyone is, you know, sort of realizing that whether it's the government or the military industrial complex or the corporations, people are becoming aware that these institutions are corrupt and don't work. And so I think that's really where we have to like start with, is building on that distrust and helping them see like, there's another alternative. There's another way that we can do things better. We can organize our society, our economy, and our political system in a more humane way that puts the interests of ordinary people first and not just a handful of these wealthy, powerful elites.
That's a pretty good way to look at the future. That's definitely more optimistic, you know, because it says like, hey, people, like, this is how we can overcome it. You know, the climate change, when we talked about climate change, that was real depressing because it's like, okay. But, you know, we actually have, you know, there's more workers than there are oligarchs. So we, as long as we can get that solidarity, we can take back the labor force and, you know, send the ship in the right direction for all of us. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've just got a few people that could really just use a good old bless your heart. Charles Koch knows a thing or two about the wealth gap in America, mainly because he has helped create it. Whether he's instructing his workers to lie and steal oil, to major union busting, he will do whatever it takes to put one more dollar in his own pocket and take it out of the quote, undeserving. Charles Koch, my gross wealth accumulation just means I'm better than you. Everybody, and thank you for staying with us through all this. We're about to close things up, but before we do, we've just got a few people that could really just use a bless your heart.
It's Bless Your Heart with Bobby June.
Hello, hello. Oh my, you little angels. Look at you, just so wonderful. Thank you, and bless your heart.
Bless your heart.
Jonathan. Who do you think needs a bless your heart for them just to make it through?
I'm going to do a good old-fashioned Southern bless your heart to Naftali Bennett and the state of Israel. He's the new prime minister, and they finally got rid of Netanyahu. But he's really hurting right now, the new prime minister, because Ben and Jerry's decided they're not going to sell ice cream in the occupied territories. And that really hurt the feelings of the Israeli government. It really is an act of terrorism that ice cream isn't going to be available in illegal settlements. So bless your heart, Israel. I'm so sorry you can't get ice cream in the occupied territories.
The thing is, like, the Jews can just go over into the mainland and get their apartheid ice cream in the mainland. Like, they're allowed to cross over. I don't see what the problem is. They have full rights and full citizenship to do whatever the hell they want to do.
Exactly.
Talking
it's
about
just such an inconvenience. You have to drive like 20 minutes away to get ice cream now.
It is the dry season. It is going to get hot and it might melt.
Yeah.
But here's a business opportunity for them, since, you know, the Israelis as full citizens, they get a little more money. They could go into mainland, buy an ice cream truck full of Ben and Jerry's and bring it in.
Drive it through the West Bank.
Any Jews in Israel listening to this, hit me up. I'll send you $500 to start this.
It is the startup nation after all.
All right, Maggie, what about you? Who needs a good old bless your heart?
So my bless your heart goes out to a woman who is running for city council here in Knoxville. And she's an anti-vaxxer. She believes in urine therapy. I don't know if you know about urine therapy, but it's using urine to treat your ailments, like insomnia, anxiety, pink eye.
Is that like when you have a jellyfish sting and you're supposed to?
Yes, they took the Friends episode way too seriously and they were like, let's make it into a whole thing. I'm pretty sure she also owns several crystals. She probably owns that tarot deck that you were talking about the last time we did a Bless Your Heart game. She probably owns that tarot deck that's super racist. Bless your heart, Elizabeth Murphy, and please, dear God, everyone that is voting in Knoxville, do not vote for her to be in city council, because, oh my God, we do not need our own Marjorie Taylor Greene in city council.
You're just going to piss away your vote if you give it to her.
Oh, that's so good.
I stole it from like 18 other people on Twitter. I'm not that original. So my bless your heart goes to our lovely Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. For those of you who aren't aware, the eviction moratorium ended at the start of August, leaving 11 million Americans wondering, am I going to have a bed tonight? And rather than trying to actually come up with some kind of good solution to this issue that, I don't know, has been on the table for the past 2 to 3 months. Speaker Pelosi immediately pivoted and said, the issue with this is it's the Republicans in Congress blocked it from happening. Well, last time I checked, the Democratic Party had a majority in both the House and kind of the Senate. So, Speaker Pelosi, bless your heart for thinking that we Americans are so dumb that you don't think that we're capable of being able to look and seeing that the blue number is higher than the red number and trying to pull the wool over our eyes to let us know that you just wanted to get on your vacation rather than stopping 11 million people from not having a home. And in that same note, thank you to Representative Cori Bush, who is bringing attention to this by staging protests on the Capitol steps. Thank you, Representative Bush. Bless your heart, Pelosi. Maybe this vacation will kind of get the cobwebs out of your head and realize that 11 million people need a place to sleep. Maybe invite them to your Airbnb. That'd be nice of you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Appreciate you guys tuning in. Do you have an internet home or any pluggables, Jonathan?
I currently don't have an internet home, but I will plug that I'm actually writing a book right now. It's an encyclopedia called The Marxian Dialogues, The Encyclopedia of Materialist Sociology. And it's designed for a mass public audience, not like a college textbook or anything. And it's going to have all kinds of colorful pictures and infographics and visuals and charts. And it's really going to just try to break down all these theories and ideas and concepts for the layperson so that you don't have to read like an 800 page, you know, book that was written 100 years ago to really understand this stuff. So The Marxian Dialogues, The Encyclopedia of Materialist Sociology is the title that I'm going for.
I cannot wait to buy 75 copies and just leave them around. In Boomer Central. I'm going to leave them in Boomer Central and just, oh no, I left my book behind at Cheesecake Factory. No one gets this.
As soon as it comes out, let us know. And we'll definitely be sure to push it out to our audience. Well, Maggie, what about you? Where do you live on the World Wide Web?
As per usual, you can find me at LILMISSKNIT. I have recently been finishing up on some of my arts and crafts thingies. So you guys can check out a lot of my beadwork that I'm probably going to be posting soon and my resin work, but also a whole lot of photos from my Louisiana trip of me just eating a lot of oysters and gator. Please enjoy. Oh, and I have a photo of me flipping off Andrew Jackson and I can't wait to post it.
Only photo he should be in.
Yes, exactly.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter @pod_south. You can find me on Twitter @Graham851. Also, make sure to leave us those sweet, sweet 5-star reviews as they help others discover us and hear the siren song of Appalachian leftists. Thanks, everyone. Have a great night.
Hot pot of the South, not your daddy's Appalachian. Hot pot of the South, progress cannot wait.